Gadadhar Shiva Sadi Gaur Bhakta Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare. So in Orissa, there's two special festival days in connection with Jayadev Goswami. The first, most appropriately perhaps, is on the day of Akshaya Tritiya. And that's the day they consider to be his appearance day. That's also the day they begin to make the Rath Yatra carts. And on that day, they have a special festival every year. They have a two-day Harinam party that goes from Ananta Vasudev Temple to the birthplace of Jayadev Goswami, Kendu Bilva, and it goes to Konark and comes eventually to Jagannath Puri. And this is modeled after a book, a 500-year-old book called Vaishnava Lilamrita by a devotee named Madhava Patnaik, who was one of the associates of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu here in Orissa. And in that book, it's described that Chaitanya Mahaprabhu would regularly do Harinam from the Ananta Vasudev Temple in Bhubaneswar, and they would go through Kendu Bilva, Kenduli, and go to Konark and come to Jagannath Puri. And it said there that when Mahaprabhu would go to Kenduli, they would sing songs from Jayadev Goswami's Gita Govinda. You can't separate Gita Govinda from Jagannath Puri and Lord Jagannath. One of the names for Jagannath is Gita Govinda Thakur. And that name was given to him by Maharaj Prataparudra. There is a plaque inside the Jagannath Mandir, which I've never seen, near to Lord Jagannath, which describes Jagannath as the Gita Govinda Thakur. And it's prescribed there that every day the devotees should sing the Gita Govinda for him. Every night, Lord Jagannath wears a special dress, and we have a picture of it, that big picture of Jagannath we have outside. That dress is called the Buddha Shringara Besh. Shringara means a Shringara Rus. Buddha means the same as Boro. In Bengali, it means big. The big dress, a Shringara Rus. And every night he wears that, and the dress that he has, the cloth, is called the Gita Govinda Kandua. And it has verses from the Gita Govinda written on it. And every night at that time, they take some sandalwood paste and they paste it on Jagannath's heart, different places on his body. And they paste tulsi leaves to Jagannath's heart with words from the Gita Govinda written on them. Gita Govinda is so very, very dear to Lord Jagannath. And Gita Govinda was composed by Srila Jayadev Goswami. I said that Jayadev Goswami in his Gita Govinda, he's written that he was a son of Bhojadev and Vamadevi, who came from the southern part of Kalinga state, or Orissa. And he was born, they say, in the first part of the 12th century during the reign of Maharaj Chota Gangadev, which means the early 1100s. Some people say that he left this world in Vrindavan, and there's other traditions that say that he left this world in his village of Kendu Bilva. In the opinion of Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, he left this world here in Jagannath Puri Dham. When we speak about Jayadev Goswami, we also have to speak about his wife, Padmavati. There was one Brahmin who came to Jagannath Puri one day during the time of the Chandan Yatra festival in the summertime when it's very hot. His name was Dave Sharma. And he and his wife, although they were a little older, they had no children. And they very much wanted to have a child. So they took a Padma, a lotus, and they went and offered that lotus to Lord Jagannath, and they prayed to him that if you give us a child, if it's a boy, then we'll make him into your servant. And if it's a girl, then we'll donate him to you as a Devadasi. And shortly after that, Deva Sharma's wife became pregnant. and a girl was born. And because they offered a Padma lotus to Lord Jagannath, and they got a child from Lord Jagannath, they named that child Padmavati. And when she became proper age, they brought her here to Jagannath Puri to offer her to Lord Jagannath. There's an ancient tradition in Jagannath Puri of lady dancers called the Devadasis. This was stopped during the 1950s. It's a long discussion about that. But they were going to offer her to be one of those Devadasis. They're considered to be like wives of Lord Jagannath. And Jagannath came in a dream to Deva Sharma and said, "No, no, don't give her to me. You should give her to my devotee." He said, "There's a young brahmachari whose name is Jayadev. And you'll find him tomorrow morning sitting outside the temple underneath a banyan tree chanting Krishna's names. And he has some deities of Radha Madhav." Those original Radha Madhav deities are today in Vrindavan in the temple of Radha Damodar. Thank you. "And you should give her to him." And so the next morning, Dave Sharma and his wife, they took their daughter, and they went, and sure enough, there was this young Brahmin there. They went to him, "What is your name?" "Oh, my name's Jayadev." "Oh, Jagannath wants you to marry my daughter." He was a little surprised. He said, I can't do that. He said, I don't have a house. I don't have a job. I don't have any money. I'm just a brahmachari." I said, "No, no." And Dave Sharma told his daughter that from now on you belong to him. I'm giving you to him. And Dave Sharma left. And Padmavati was kind of standing there looking at Jayadev. And he's looking at her. And he said, "Look, lady, I'm really sorry. But I can't do this. You know, I have no way to take care of you. I'm sure you're really a nice girl and everything. It's okay, but I'm a brahmachari. And I don't have any money or anyway, so it's okay, you can go home." And Padmavati began to cry. And she said, "I have no home. My home is wherever you're at." She's such a high-class person. "My father gave me to you, so now you're my master. And you can do whatever you want with me." So he accepted her as his wife. And he began to write the Gita Govinda. They had a very special household life. Sometimes we think that household life is Maya and that only renunciation is bhakti. This is a big misunderstanding. Jiva Goswami in his Durgama Sangamani Tika in the 11th verse of Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, he says that if someone thinks that you have to have renunciation, otherwise you can't have bhakti, then that's covering bhakti, and it's wrong. Because bhakti is swarat, bhakti is independent. It doesn't depend on anything else. And the Samoyan Tantra describes that Hari Lila Satochara Pareshu Satatam Tvaya Karya Pritistavahara Yata Bhakti Manashiti. We should love devotees. But we should love them because they speak Krishna Katha, because they do Krishna Kirtan, because they're doing Guru Seva, Krishna Seva. And we should love them in that way. And so between Padmavati and Jayadev Goswami, there was a very intense bond of love. We don't really understand what love is in this material world. We think it means something they sing about in the songs and we watch in the cinema. But that's not real love. Because real love is ahoitaki apratiyata, with no motivation and no interruption. And all the love that we hear about in the songs and the movies, there's a motivation, maybe a lusty one or an economic one or whatever. And there's some interruption. It ends at a certain point. But in the love of Jayadev and Padmavati, it was very pure. It was based on Krishna. And they were simply inspiring each other in their bhakti, in their devotion to the Lord. And Jayadeva Goswami began to write his celebrated poem, Gita Govinda, which has been translated, I think, in 100 different languages, something like that. Yeah, around 100 different languages. It's probably the most famous, one of the most famous poems in the entire world. And it's dramatically affected, especially the writings in Orissa. and all over India. He was writing that book, and one day he was thinking something, and he thought, I can't write that. That's too far out. No, but he had a writer's block, and he was stuck. So he told Padmavati, he said, anyway, I'm going to go and take my bath in the river, and I'll be back in a little while. Please have my lunch ready when I come back. And he went out, and just maybe 10, 15 minutes later, he came back to the door. And Padmavati was surprised. Oh, you came back early today. He said, yes, I was thinking about what I'm writing, and it's something I have to do. So she said, well, here, your lunch is ready. Okay. So Jayadev sat down and took his lunch, and he said, I have to finish this writing. And he went into his room, closed the door. And then 5 minutes later, Jayadev Goswami came to the front door again. And Padmavati was, what's going on? You were just here, she said. You came in and ate your lunch. And Jayadev is looking at her. He said, is there something wrong with you? He came in and she was eating her lunch. And he was a little confused because Padmavati was a very chaste wife. And Vedic tradition is that the wife would eat her meal after the husband. And she would always do like that. He couldn't understand, why is she eating before him? And she said, well, you were just here. You came in and you had your lunch. You came back early from your bath. And then you went into the room to do some writing. He's looking at her. What are you saying? So he went into the room. Nobody was there. And he found his manuscript that he was writing. And there was a new verse written in golden ink. Smaragar lakandanam mama sirasi mandanam dehi pada palavam udaram jalati maya dharanam marana karandaranlo hadati taru pahita vikaran. It's spoken by Krishna. Jayadev was thinking to himself, I'd like to write about how Krishna is begging Radharani for the dust from her lotus feet. But he thought, I can't write that. Krishna is God. How can he be begging the dust from his devotee? No, it's not appropriate. But when he came into his room, the exact thing that he was thinking about was written in his book in golden ink. And translation is, O Radhe, please ornament my head with the fresh lotus buds of your feet. Those flower feet will counteract Cupid's poison of the love I feel in separation from you, and extinguish the harsh fire of amorous desires that rages within my heart. When Jayadev Goswami saw that, he became ecstatic and he started crying and his hair stood on end. He started jumping up and down. Haribo, Haribo. He said, and then all of a sudden he realized something and he went running into the other room and Padmavati was still finishing her lunch. What's going on with my husband? Acting a little weird today. And suddenly, like a madman, he grabbed her plate and he started eating the remnants from his wife off the plate. And Papa, hey, what are you doing? No, no. And he said, you are the most fortunate. He said, some people think you're my wife and you're my servant, but from now on, I'm your servant. Because you're such a dear devotee of Jagannath. He came to the house and you had his darshan. He took my form. And he came in and you fed him lunch. He ate what you cooked for him. And on this plate that you're eating off of, this is the remnants of Lord Jagannath and the remnants of Jagannath's dear devotee, Padmavati. I worship you. They had such a relationship. Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, he said once that Vaishnav marriage is not the same as Vedic marriage. He said in Vaishnav marriage, it's not that the wife serves the husband or the husband serves the wife. They're Vaishnavas. How can you accept service from another Vaishnav? He said, but rather they serve each other for the pleasure of Guru and Krishna. And this was the nature of the relationship between Padmavati and Jayadev Goswami. It was really a relationship of pure love, of pure bhakti. And Padmavati, she began to sing the Gita Govinda every day. And she was picking some eggplant one day. And as she was picking this eggplant, she was singing Gita Govinda, and she heard some sound in the bushes. Maybe there's some creepy guy there watching her or something. I don't know. I don't see anything. She kept singing Gita Govinda. And then later that day, when the pujaris went to serve Lord Jagannath, they couldn't figure out why Lord Jagannath has all these thorns and bits of eggplant things stuck to his body. And then he found out Lord Jagannath, he was following Padmavati every day. She was singing in such a beautiful way. The Lord Jagannath was following her. Devotees, they like to hear Gita Govinda. They like to hear songs sung with devotion. Srila Prabhupada, he used to travel with Jamuna, and he would have Jamuna sing on the stage in front of thousands of people. And Prabhupada relished it so much. He appreciated it so much. So Jayadeva and Padmavati, they had such an amazing relationship. Once Maharaj Chodagangadev's wife, she had heard so much about the chastity of Padmavati. So that queen didn't have such a pure heart, I'm sorry to say. But she wanted to test the devotion of Padmavati for her husband. And so when Jayadeva had gone somewhere else one day, the queen went to see Padmavati and she said, "Oh, Padmavati, I have very bad news." Padmavati said, "What is it? You haven't heard? Something happened and your husband, he died." When Padmavati heard that, she fell to the ground, dead. And they called for so many doctors, there was no pulse. And all the devotees and everyone, and then the queen was horrified. "Oh my God, what did I do? I was just wanting to test her. I thought this would be kind of a cute thing to do. I didn't realize." And so she had to go and tell Jayadev, "I did this thing, and your wife, she died." And Jayadeva Goswami began crying. Sometimes we think it's Maya. If a husband cries for the wife, or the wife cries for the husband, look, Prabhu, you should just be detached. You know, dehino smenyata dehe kumaram yovanam jara. You're not this body. But that's a very basic understanding of spiritual life. And far higher than that is to understand we should cry. We should cry more in separation from devotees. That's bhakti. And Padmavati and Jayadeva Goswami, their relationship was completely spiritual. So Jayadeva went there and seeing his wife lying there dead, in separation from her, with great feeling, he began to sing some verses from the Gita Govinda. And when he began singing that, suddenly Padmavati's eyes opened and she came back to life. So we'll just finish with a verse. We can think about something in this connection. It's from Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu. Rupa Goswami's described. Ganavaragrayo bhakti prabesayo payogita isha pratamam eviti nangatvam uchitam tayo yad ube chitta katinya hetu praya satamate sukumara sabaveyam bhaktis tad hetu irita. He says that Gyan and Vairagya have very little utility in bhakti and only in the beginning of the path. They are not angas of pure bhakti. Sadhus who are well conversant with the true nature of bhakti say that Gyan and Vairagya make the heart become hard, whereas bhakti is tender by nature. And bhakti is its own cause. Bhaktis tad hetu irita. Nothing else can be the cause of bhakti. So Jiva Goswami in his Durgama Sangamani Tika and Mukunda Das in their commentaries, they both describe that Gyan and Vairagya are actually not beneficial for bhakti. In the very beginning, they can be a little helpful because maybe we're too attached to sinful activities. And so Gyan and Vairagya can help us to stop that. But bhakti is the source of all gyan and all vairagya, the Bhagavatam describes. And we see this in the pastime of Jayadeva Goswami and his dear wife Padmavati. So It's our duty as devotees to think about the Lord and think about His pastimes. And we also want to think about His great devotees, especially on their appearance and disappearance days, so that some of their moods, some of their feelings may come to our hearts. And we pray to them on these days for their mercy. Srila Jayadeva Goswami ki.
Jai.
Shri Padmavati Devi ki.
Jai.
Gopremanandi. Bancha Kalpadubhischa. Kripa Sindhu Bhivacha. Vidhanam Bhavani Vishnavi.
Everybody would just move up about a foot, just in case people come late, they have at least some space. Reading from the Madhyalila, chapter 13, text 15. Jai Jai Sri Chaitanya Jaya Nityananda.
Jai Jai Sri Chaitanya Jaya Nityananda.
Jai Advaita Chandra Jai Gaur Bhakta Vrinda.
Jai Advaita Chandra Jai Gaur Bhakta Vrinda.
Jai Jai Sri Chaitanya Jaya Nityananda.
Jai Jai Sri Chaitanya Jaya
Jai Advaita Chandra Jai Gaur Bhakta Vrinda.
Jai Advaita Chandra Jai Gaur Bhakta Vrinda.
Jai Jai Sri Chaitanya Jaya Nityananda.
Jai Jai Sri Chaitanya Jaya Nityananda.
Jai Advaita Chandra Jai Gaur Bhakta Vrinda.
Jai Advaita Chandra Jai Gaur Bhakta Vrinda.
Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om 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 Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Tabe prata parudra kari apane shevana suvana marjani laya kari pata samarjana. While the Lord was being carried from the throne to the car, King Prataparudra personally engaged in the Lord's service by cleansing the road with a broom that had a golden handle. The king sprinkled the road, little lower just to begin, then once I get. The king sprinkled the road with sandalwood scented water. Although he was the owner of the royal throne, he engaged in menial service for the sake of Lord Jagannath. Although the king was the most respectable person, still he accepted menial service for the Lord. He therefore became a suitable candidate for receiving the Lord's mercy. Upon seeing the king engaged in such menial service, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu became very happy. Simply by rendering this service, the Lord received the mercy. The king received the mercy of the Lord. So I'll read the commentary. And the commentary and the book are very, very special. You know, Srila Prabhupada used to wake up at 1 in the morning, latest. He used to go to bed at 10, 11 o'clock at night. We just have a couple hours sleep. And the first thing he would do is translate, because once the sun rose, the Hare Krishna movement awoken with, it's inconceivable that Prabhupada was able to manage the Hare Krishna movement. Because management means you have to think of other people's minds. And they weren't that mature. So, and translate, it took, you know, I used to live in the guest house of the ISKCON guest house on the top floor. I used to wake up early also, not that early, a little bit later. And I used to look out the window, and Prabhupada was sitting on his porch. And he had this book that had, I think it's 16 commentaries on each verse of the Bhagavatam. And he'd be reading it, and then he had a dictaphone, and then he'd be speaking it. And then he was so efficient, and it shows you what happens when you're actually, your mind is not distracted and you can focus. It's almost inconceivable what someone could accomplish. You know, if we just, you know, maybe registered in our mind, you know, in our day and looked how much time, what to speak of media, of frivolous media, how much time our thoughts, you know, how much time in the day that we actually are productive. You know, and he was so productive that he became far ahead of his book publishing unit. And, you know, Prabhupada was also very practical that, you know, to publish books, they have to be, well, they have to be published, they have to be done and have to be distributed. And he was getting so far ahead. So he said that he wanted all 18 volumes, he wanted them completed in 2 months. And then the head of the publishing said, you know, that's impossible. And Prabhupada said, impossible is a word in the fool's dictionary. And then it shows you what happens when people are inspired out of love, the kind of sacrifice they can make. And then in 2 months, they actually published 18 volumes. And to show how Prabhupada can create a community, can you imagine having 5 artists work on one painting? See, they had like a you know, different people doing the background, the details, and it was completed. And he considered these purports his personal ecstasy, because they're not just scholarship. They're born out of his compassion. He wasn't doing this to become famous. In fact, one of the glories of Prabhupada is that he didn't become famous commensurate with what he did. Even when I was preaching in South India in 1976, traveling from village to village, people were talking about Prabhupada's disciple, not even Prabhupada. In other words, a young guy, maybe 25 years old, became famous, Achyutananda Swami. They said, oh yes, we have heard you're Achyutananda Swami. They didn't even hear of Prabhupada. So he did it out of compassion, because people are suffering due to ignorance. Ultimately, if you analyze it on every level and you analyze it philosophically, ultimate suffering of every kind is initially born of ignorance. I've been giving seminars on the Yoga Sutras, and they define ignorance. It says that specifically. The root cause is ignorance. And ignorance is destroyed by knowledge. So the greatest work that someone can do is share knowledge. Because if you don't change a person's conceptions, or we said yesterday, if you don't change a person's ideas, you won't change a person's thoughts. If you don't change a person's thoughts, you won't change their actions. If you don't change their actions, you won't change their habits. If you don't change their habits, you won't change their character. And if you don't change their character, you won't change their destination. And if the wrong thoughts are there, our decisions, this is Hito Pradesh, a famous book, a moral book, our decisions determine our fate. And what do you make your decisions on? You make your decisions on based on the knowledge you have. You make the wrong... What we are now, every problem we are facing now, we have caused by a decision that we have made in the past. And it's so crucial right now. And you need two things to make a proper decision. Okay, I'll give the credit to Bori John Prabhu because he said it. You need Jnana and Vairagya. And I love the way he said it. If you don't have knowledge, you won't know what to do. And if you don't have discipline, you can't do it. So, it's so important. So Prabhupada invested so much time and sacrifice in his... So, let's read his personal ecstasy. Unless one receives the mercy of the Lord, one cannot understand the Supreme Personality of Godhead or engage in his devotional service. Atapi te deva padambuja dvaya. A devotee who has received even a small fraction of the mercy of the Lord can understand him. Others may engage in theoretical speculation to understand the Lord, but they cannot know anything about him. Just thinking of one scholar in India called Dayananda Saraswati. He had memorized 6,000 books. People really, I mean, I've seen it in India. You know, sometimes I speak a few words, a few realizations. Oh, Maharaj, you're really a scholar. I know what a scholar is. There are people that are scholars. I mean, they memorize 6,000 books. But one time he was worshiping a Shiva Linga and a rat came and passed stool and he just threw out the Vedas because it recommended that. Although King Maharaj Prataparuja was very eager to see Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, the Lord refused to see him. When Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu saw the king engaged in menial service for Lord Jagannath, he became very happy. Thus the king became eligible to receive Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's mercy. If a devotee accepts Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu as the universal guru and Lord Jagannath as the Supreme Personality of Godhead Krishna, he is benefited by the combined mercy of Krishna and Guru. That is stated by Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu in his instructions to Rupa Goswami. Madhya Leela 19.151. Brahmanda Brahmate Konya Bhagavan Jeev Guru Krishna Pisadi Pai Bhakti Lata Bij. The seed of devotional service fructifies and becomes a transcendental kripa. Finally, it reaches the lotus feet of the Lord in the spiritual sky. This seed is obtained by the mercy of the Lord and the Guru. By the Lord's mercy, one gets the association of a bona fide Guru. By the mercy of the Guru, one gets a chance to render devotional service. Devotional service, the science of Bhakti Yoga, carries one from this material world to the spiritual world. A little soft at the beginning, but then once the lecture, I don't get distracted. Okay. So, anyway, what I want to do here is we're trying to discuss this whole Leela, the Lord's ecstatic dancing at Rath Yatra. And in discussing it, it's also helpful that you get a mental image of what's happening. And I'm trying to kind of put together the different components. And one of the components is King Prataparudra getting the mercy of of Lord Chaitanya. Before I get into that, I just wanted to mention something too, is that, you know, when you perform and you absorb yourself in devotional service, it's natural that realizations come. Because Krishna is responsive. And when you're performing devotional service, you're hankering to serve. You're expressing that desire to serve. And in the path of bhakti, the object of the meditation which you're serving is not just a prop. It's a person, so there's reciprocation. And generally you have realizations then. And realizations generally mean, you know, you reflect on something spiritual or you think of something material and then look at it in a spiritual way. So I was just thinking this morning, you know, when I was chanting, somehow it came in my mind, this is an anxiety I have. You know, and it's basically too, but it's not something like it's an anxiety, but it's within devotional service. It's things that you do naturally. And then I kind of thought, let me get rid of this anxiety. You know, and try not to do this and do this and do. And when my mind went around like that, and I followed my mind trying to get rid of, you know, making my plan to be happy. You know, I just realized it's like I had the wrong plan. Because the plan is not changing the things you do. It's more changing how you think about them. And not only that, it's more becoming fortified in your objective or goal. And when you become fortified in your objective or goal, you place a different value on the things that you do. And then what is the objective or goal is we want to change our consciousness. Because that's the ultimate cause of suffering. So I just kind of, you know, after I went like that a while, I went, nah. Do your duty and fight. Do what you have to do. Change your consciousness. There's a very moving book called A Search for Meaning. It's written by an Austrian psychologist who in the Holocaust was thrown into the concentration camps. It's almost a hard book to read. When you actually understand how much people were tortured, you know. But, you know, and he saw who lived and who died. And the people who lived are the people who had some meaning in their life. They had some real meaning in their life. And that was applied to the circumstance. So, you know, we read and we study and we practice because we're trying to actually get a proper conception of what this world's about and what's our purpose in it and how to achieve, you know, what our purpose is. And ultimately our purpose, actually, our purpose, when you get down to the raw existential vision of reality, our purpose is that our consciousness should be an offering of love. And our heart should be a suitable place for that love to rest. Because that's the only way we're going to be happy, and that's the only way we're going to make others happy. And that's actually who we are. We're ultimately consciousness. And consciousness reaches its fruition in love. And that's what the path of bhakti yoga is. It's the path of changing the consciousness. Purifying. And what does purifying the consciousness mean? It means giving up things that are actually external to it. I remember in the Bhagavatam, it's so instructive, especially that first canto. Maharaj Prickett, the signs come that life is temporary. Life is temporary, but God speaks louder as you get older. He says, you know that hip that was moving me around fast? You know that hair that was fully on my head? You know those knee, you know, the arthritis, the sitting up. And the signs come. God speaks. And he says, that's temporary. Seek the eternal. And anyway, the life of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is the example of how it's achieved from the beginning to the end. Because he's God, but God trying to become... You're not translating. But what about the poor people in the back? Okay. Okay, she's doing it. Okay. All right. I got it. So his life is that. And in that life, his practice becomes more and more concentrated. And what is the practice in bhakti? The practice in bhakti is developing love. And what does love mean? Love means relationship. So it means developing a relationship with God and developing a loving relationship with God. And the process is to absorb your consciousness in God in the form of his holy name and develop a relationship with the person whose name you are chanting. That's called sambandha. Because the more you have relationship, the more you have love, the more you will become absorbed until it comes to the stage of perfection, prema. And what does prema mean? Sandrandana visheshatma. Sandrandana means, if you look, a piece of metal is called sandra. Sandra means you can't take a pin and put that pin through the metal. So at a particular time, your consciousness is so much in love with reality, the beautiful, which includes everything. You're so much in love that there's nothing else in your consciousness. In bhakti also, there's the stages of dhyana and samadhi. And the stage of dhyana means is that your consciousness is so much flowing on the right object of reality, which is reality itself, which is God, that your meditation is like if you pour some oil, it's just, there's no space between one thing and another. So there's no space between your thoughts of your beloved God. But the higher stage is samadhi. And the difference between samadhi and dhyana is in samadhi, the meditation is so fixed that you're not even cognizant of anything else outside. In dhyana, you're cognizant. You know, you're fixed, but you're cognizant. You lose the complete awareness in samadhi. You enter into that depth of absorption. Prema pumarta mahan. Artha means value, mahan. The greatest value is to get that prema and that love in one's heart. So Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, he searches the light. He begins in some way, you know, and he meets his teacher. And because of his qualification, He's God as a devotee, so we hope that he's sincere. He surrenders, and he changes. And then when that, as mentioned here, that seed, what is the bhakti lata bij? It's the seed of devotion. And it's described that the greatest thing that can happen is if you get that seed of devotion. And it gives this image. If we want to look, Brahman means broad-minded. Right? What is broad-minded? You see the whole picture. This is not broad-minded. You have dysentery. You have a bad stomach. And then you come down and there's the feast. And you see the beginning of the meal and you see the end of the meal. You don't see what you would like before and you don't see what you will like after. So when you get transcendental knowledge, you become more and more. You become more and more broad-minded. That's why a child needs guidance. They're not broad-minded. Hopefully the parents have a greater perspective. You know, they can see. The young teenager only sees the next party. Parent hopefully is saying, well, what about when you're 25? And what if you're... You see, broad-minded perspective. So, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, so what's the bhakti lata bij? The broad-minded perspective is, and it's hard to keep in our consciousness, one, this is not the self. We've transmigrated not only from species of life to species of life, but from universe to universe. Someone who has right consciousness, he's seeing that. Brahmanda Brahmanda. And then something happens. And what is it? It's mercy. One gets the seed of reality, the seed of devotion. And what is that seed of devotion? What is the bhakti lata bij? This is my analysis of it. It's a conception and it's an experience. It's a conception, and sometimes the experience comes first. In New York, our glorious Ram Roy, you know, went out and decided to distribute the holy name after tasting it in Vrindavan for so many years. It's really glorious to see. He's ready to die on the streets of New York. Sacrificing Vrindavan. And you could... But, you know, so I go out there sometimes, and it's a great spot in Union Square, because the subway, like where that back row is where the people come out. And by the law of New York, they own that spot now. They've been there for a year. It's theirs. And they're also protected by the people in the park who respect the law of New York. I met this big guy came. I was walking over there, and there's like these chess hustlers. And this big guy comes up to me and says, you know, I really like the sound there. I really like you guys there. I'm good in my fists. Have any problem, you just let me know. Even the policemen, yeah, a little humor people like. Okay, even the policemen become respectful. Because the Hasidic Jews have their Sankirtan there for 2 weeks. So there's about a foot between them. You know? And they're chanting and the police come up and say, do you think, is it possible that you, a policeman in New York respect, do you think you could move over about a foot? Okay, sure. But when I'm with Ram Roy, and you hear his sincere realizations, he says when he does that kirtan, he looks out, and one of the joys is seeing the bhakti lata bij being planted in people's hearts. And when I go out there, it really is. You know, you're doing kirtan, and you look, and you see some. Because that would be the subway, and there's thousands of people just pouring out constantly. And you do kirtan, and you watch someone stop. And then you watch them stop. And then they look. And then they stay there for an hour. You know, and like, and you watch that something's happening. Okay, shut that door there. Something is happening. Something is happening in the heart. You see it. They're looking at it. They can't really figure it out, but there's something very attractive about it. What is it? And what the Bhakti Lata Beej means is there's an experience. First, there's generally, there begins with a conception, an understanding that there's a goal of life. The goal of life is to love God. And not only is it a conception, it's an experience that there is nothing better than this. And it enters into the heart. And then as one advances in spiritual life, very intelligent. No one else heard the frog in my throat?
He gets the creeper.
It's not going to help anyway, but Destiny just spoke. Eat less sweets. So, it's a conception and an experience. And the experience just deepens and deepens and deepens. And that's also faith. It just increases the conviction based on the experience. So, that's mercy. That's mercy. Somehow or other. And the only thing we can do is make ourselves receptive to it. There's a verse in the Bhagavatam, Dharmasya Yapavargasya. Very interesting. It says that Dharma, usually you say that Dharma, religion, is meant for artha, economic development. Then from economic development, you get your senses, kama, and then from that comes moksha. You become frustrated. You're satisfied, but frustrated. That's a good culture. You become satisfied, but frustrated. Yeah, I got what I want, but it's not that good. Then moksha, liberation. But this says dharmasya yapavargasya. That Dharma is meant for liberation. So they say, what? How? And it explains the whole purpose of the Varnashram cultural system is that it creates a culture of respect that you may appreciate a Vaishnav who walks into your door. And from that, the mercy of Krishna may come. Now, in this particular story, as we're following, of course, I'm saying, so the spiritual practice is that absorption. You have to develop some bandha, and that's by hearing about the glories of the person whose name you're chanting and worshiping the form of the person whose name you're chanting. So therefore, in the practice of devotional service, to get that spiritual consciousness, you're generally in a line of teachers connected to a form of God. And in Bhakti Sandarbha, Jiva Goswami defines initiation as Divya Gyan. It's the bestowal of divine consciousness. And it says it has two aspects, Sambandha Vishesh Gyan and Bhagavat Sarup Gyan. You get the form of God whom you're worshiping, and you get the seed of that relationship with that form. And we see it in the Hare Krishna movement, especially when everyone was in the temples. When even now, whatever it is, when you get initiated, the second initiation, then all of a sudden you're eligible to worship the deity. And then what happens is, it's almost as if Prabhupada gave you a relationship with the form of God, whatever temple you are in. Lakshmi Moni, you look interested. Okay. But now I'm going to tell a story how I got my first Gita and embarrass you. I was in the university. But it's related to the deity. I was in the university, State University of New York at Binghamton, and I was starting to become Krishna conscious a bit. So, you know, I don't know, one night I just didn't feel like going out anymore. You know, so I stopped going out. I just like a party or what. I lived about 30 minutes from the campus, but one day I just said, no, I should go to the student union. And I got in my green Volkswagen Beetle. And I drove to the student union, and there were two devotees at the front counter of the thing, and they were talking to a person. I even remember the guy's name, Bob Fireman. And then they came and they said to me that, Bob Fireman pointed to me because I used to kind of cook feast. I didn't know what I was doing, but I cook feast and serve people prasadam. I don't know. He's a Hare Krishna. And then you and Jagadish looked at me and said, we knew that there must have been a devotee here because Lord Jagannath's picture is behind the reception counter of the counter. And then I was like saying, who's Lord Jagannath? I never even knew how that picture got there. But anyway, they had one day to pick up the deities from New York and get back over the border. And that was Radha Shirachora Gopinath. Really? I did that much service? So look at the mercy, right? And then I had an apartment, and I gave them a room in the apartment. Those are the days where apartments were $80 a month, two bedrooms. They gave them apartment. And then, you know, they got up early in the morning and then drove there and then picked it up. They left early in the morning, and Jagadish was cooking hot milk at night, and he told me to read Krishna book to him. So, and then they went. So. Okay. I feel like, I need a drum roll because I got to do this in a short time. It is long. So, but anyway. Worshipping Jagannath, and what's the form of Jagannath? It corresponds to so everyone got deities. If they were in New York, then Radha Govinda became their Ishtadev, and you know it was an amazing phenomena because great acharyas in our movement, Rupa Goswami, you know they established you know Radha Govinda. In there, and Madhu Pandit, Radha Gopinath, and Sanatan Goswami, Madan Mohan. So see the scope of Prabhupada's mercy. He established these Radha Krishna deities in practically every city in the world. And a lot of times the temples fell apart and the only one preaching was the deities. Because the people were so attached to these deities. Because it's a sambandha and it's a reciprocation and a relationship. So Lord Chaitanya, so the deity corresponds to the desire you have to serve God. Like as a child, Bal Gopal in this relate, cowherd boy, Krishna Balaram. So Jagannath aspires, Jagannath is the form of the Lord that corresponds with the aspiration of God to experience the love of Radha in her deepest moment of separation. Because Jagannath is the form of Krishna in separation from Radharani and in ecstatic symptoms. So we come in his life, it's the middle of his life, and he's doing the kirtan, and we describe what that kirtan looks like. But one of the main themes here that's running, if you go for 20 chapters back, it's a main theme that's being culminated. It's beginning to reach its fruition, is that there's a king, and he's the king of Puri. King Prataparuja, maybe the king of Orissa. He's the king. And he's in charge of the temple, the king. But somehow or other, he loves Chaitanya Mahaprabhu so much, but by the social structure, a renunciate just will not associate with the king. The king is called Vishayi, the object of enjoyment. We explain that. In that type of monarchy, to facilitate rulership, and means populace is materialistic, they become reverent to power. It's still a core principle. So they have accoutrements of power. And therefore the monk, he wouldn't deal with that in that kind, when it made sense when the social structure was set up and functioning. You transport a lot of these things to the 20th century, you can't understand them. 21st century. But when it was, if you see the structure, it's kind of, again, it was a community. Everyone had roles that served the objectives of everyone. And people set different examples and so, he could never get the mercy of the Lord. Or he apparently couldn't. And he used to lament and cry. Lord Chaitanya is the Patita Pavana. He is the deliverer of everyone, except one person, and that is me. He was lamenting so much. And, you know, because devotees are compassionate, Jivadoi Krishna Nam Sarva Dharma Sar. Jivadoi Krishna. The essence of all religion, and this is Bhaktivinoda Thakur, is Jivadoi, is to show compassion, especially by giving people bhakti. So the devotees, they're so pained that this devotee is suffering because he can't meet the object of his love. He's just tortured by it. And the devotees, and they petition Lord Chaitanya, please, you know, give him a little mercy. Lord, if you bring it up again, I'll leave immediately. Of course, you can't judge things out of context. You have to see the whole context. Sometimes the separation from that object of love is only a preparation to appreciate that object of love or to get that object of love. There's a Persian proverb, which we will all relish when I tell you. When God is digging a ditch to throw you in, he's actually digging a well to quench your thirst. You just can't tell it at the time when you're on the tip of the branch and God has the saw and it's going over the cliff. What are you doing? It actually works that way. We always understand that. So, somehow or other, I mean, I kind of wrote some questions that maybe we can meditate on. I don't, and maybe even discuss during the day, and maybe in my last class I could discuss them. Because I do want to, we can discuss, if you can only understand God by mercy, what is the role of cultivating knowledge? Why should we cultivate knowledge if we can only understand God by mercy? And if mercy is undeserved kindness, why? Because of service did he receive mercy? Mercy is undisturbed. But here it said, because of this he got it. So has he earned it? And if he earned it, how is it mercy? And what about menial service? What does that mean? I mean, can't you be a big person and do service humbly? Why the menial service? Why not? He's ruling the kingdom for God. Why didn't he get the mercy then? What attracted that mercy? Well, let's discuss at least one of them. If you can only understand God by mercy. Well, anyway, let me discuss. Yeah, first of all, without humility is the key to spiritual life, especially bhakti. Because really, one definition I thought, a good definition of humility, is to take dictation from something higher than your whims. Take dictation from something higher than your whims. And that's what service is. Service is to take dictation from something other than your whims. That's what service means. Service is really an amazing thing. Just think what a mood of service does. The mood of service puts yourself into the world of another person. You're in his world because it's according to his desires. When you serve someone, like when we serve our Gurudev, Srila Prabhupada, the world is dictated by his desire, what he wants. That's humility. Because the false ego is exactly the opposite. The false ego means Eric Fromm, right? Fromm. In a book called The Art of Loving, he gave a very interesting definition of narcissistic and love. He said, people who are narcissistic, they see the world according to their own desires. an example would be is if I'm a skinny monk and I'm always freezing. And it's the middle of the summer, but I'm still always freezing. But everyone else is very hot. So they have the fan on and a little air conditioning. And I'm the skinny monk who's always freezing. So I come into the room and I say, shut off the fan and shut off the air conditioning. Because I see the world as cold. The world should, you know, then the world should have no air conditioning. And so humility is so essential for any type of love or service. Because love means you have to see the world according to someone else's desire. Of course, now, because it can be misunderstood, it's not the insanity of codependence when you're following the whim of someone else who's crazy. And you're following the whim of someone else who's crazy because somehow you see that according to your own desire. You're just appropriating someone so you can be part of their world and control others or something. It's not humility. It's very deep. So you have to be humble to perform service. And to get mercy. Because what mercy is, ultimately, it's a love. Mercy is a love. I remember when I went to a seminar on Vaishnava etiquette by His Holiness Bhakti True Maharaj. He said, respect goes upwards, affection goes downwards. So affection, called anugraha, in Sanskrit it's the same word, it's mercy. That comes from the superior. Of course, I mean, it is semantics, but it's not that, you know, Gurudev, I'm giving you my mercy. Mercy goes down. Mercy comes down. So it's a relationship. So love is a relationship. So it comes in relationship, and we have a part in that relationship. We respect. And we respect by humility and by service. But what we get is something so far beyond what we actually give. So, what attracts mercy is a consciousness which is humble, dependent, and therefore in need of mercy. When there's need, right? Like the little dogs in Puri.
You can get mercy though if you don't need it too.
What? I love it.
But you're going to probably go down the road.
Just like you see something, and if it looks dependent, then you give it something. Right? They didn't earn it. But there's something there in the constitution, the condition of need. And if we understand that God is the supreme person, that means there must be love. There must be love. So the practice of bhakti So, somehow or other, the king, because that position so much puts you in the center. When he performed the menial service, when there was an expression that actually I'm not the king. That's not my designation. I'm something else. I'm a servant. And here, look, I don't have that, because that any type of designation that forced his pride within you will shield you from that kind of expression of need. That will invoke that feeling of affection and mercy. So the king has that designation. And it's so powerful. And as long as he identifies with it, he's not going to identify with that. So he does the humble serve. Anyway, I want to stop for questions because things can go on and on and on. And I think that's also important. Lakshmi?
Earlier in your discourse, you mentioned suffering is due to ignorance.
Yeah.
There's a couple ways you could look at that. One is, I must suffer.
Yeah.
It's part of the healing process.
Yeah.
If I'm traumatized. Or
yeah.
Whatever. Another way to look at it is, I'm suffering, but and I know I'm suffering, and I know I don't want to suffer, but I'm my mind is attached to the event or the person or whatever the situation is causing the suffering. And then the third perspective is, of course, all suffering is due to ignorance, and I don't want to be in ignorance, and therefore you develop a very lucid perspective on the events or the persons or whatever that has caused your suffering. So how do you answer the person who says, you know, suffering is part of the healing process. I have to go through this. I have to experience this.
It may be part of the healing process, right? Oh, let me try to rephrase your if someone is mistreated,
right?
And they're suffering, then you just can't throw it back on them and say, no, it's just your karma, it's Krishna's mercy, right? Yeah. But ultimately, when a person becomes thoughtful and when a person becomes philosophical, right, at the appropriate time, you see, there's psychology and there's philosophy. You know, I remember that you know, I really didn't like this person, and this person was really, really causing me, you know. So I had a friend, and he thought, well, this may not be good for my Krishna consciousness. So I went, you know, so he said, I want to give you a little exercise here. So I said, what's that exercise? He said, I want you to close your eyes. And I want you to think of that person. And I wanted to think what you feel. But I've got that no clue. You know? So I was like, you know, really. And then he said, okay, look at that person's face. He said, okay, now put your own face in its place. And, you know, kind of the anger subsided. But I appreciated the person. I mean, there's a practical application of the philosophy. Now, I discussed the principle. Ultimately, whatever suffering comes to us, it's related to ourselves on a very, very high platform. But that doesn't mean that there are not some emotional responses that are needed and we have to work through. So the person was very intelligent. You know, he understood that, you know, I can't renounce that emotion. It's not even healthy, nor can I do it. You know what I'm saying? But I have to somehow embrace that anger, that things and thing. And then, you know, it's a psychological thing. Sometimes, you know, we need that. But, you know, I think we have to be very careful that, you know, in philosophy, you know, there are principles. And the real intelligence is, you know, putting them in different places. Yes.
You have to repeat the part of your first
what?
Question was that if mercy is the only way to
attain
God, why do we need knowledge about the relationship? And the next part of the question is about the discipline which you mentioned and has it to be both factors of the other one.
Why do we you want me to just answer the question I asked, right? Yeah. There are things that we can do that facilitate a certain experience without the conception that we're causing that experience. So it's not just by the knowledge alone, but by the proper understanding. Way I look at it in terms of, like, we talk, Vishakha Mataji was talking about faith. You know, how you get faith, right? How you get... So what I see is this, is I'm just thinking when I came to Krishna consciousness, two things happened. One, I got an experience and I got a philosophy that kept my mind open to that experience. In other words, if I got an experience, right, and then I didn't get knowledge, the doubts would close my mind and even my body from the proximity to that experience. You know, doubts close the mind. You know, faith allows you to move in a particular direction. Doubts will stop that movement. So in terms of pursuing Krishna consciousness, if one has doubts, right, you won't do the things that open your mind to that experience. And I quoted from Bhakti Sandarbha. It was such a in Bhakti Sandarbha, it was such a interesting point. It was talking about such a great book, Bhakti Sandarbha. I hope the BBT gets to it. It's the most practical. It's the analysis of bhakti. So it discusses Mahabhagavat, great devotee. You know, it says that everyone will be influenced by a Mahabhagavat, even if you don't know who that person is, except one person. One who has a little knowledge and is proud. And you see that as soon as someone thinks they know something, they know better, or they're proud of their knowledge, they shut themselves off to the influence of bhakti. So when someone has like so when I look at my own personal experience, I had a, you know, coming to Krishna consciousness was a religious experience because it was supra sensuous, supra. You know, I didn't have any frame of reference for that type of happiness that would come to me in terms of manipulation of the senses, manipulation of the ego. I had no frame of reference for it. But I experienced something. I experienced something in the prasadam. I experienced something in the holy name, the kirtan. You know, but there was something else that happened. I came in contact with authority of knowledge, and it was so clear that anything in my environment could be the understanding, the meaning, and the relevance of it can be explained. And because I had that type of knowledge, you know, it kept me in proximity of the devotees and the experience. You know, even sometimes where the experience is taken away due to offenses. As Bhurijan Prabhu said, he's a very wise person, so he can be quoted a lot. He said, we're all pure devotees until we got a taste for power.
you know, once you got the positions and once, you know, so what I look at it that, you know, we hear, right? But you can't pursue something without you can't pursue any endeavor if you don't have faith. And to have faith, doubts have to be clear. So it's the same thing. The mercy will come, but you can shut yourself off to the experience of the mercy. You know, or you can make an expression in your heart that I don't need the mercy. And that expression is called pride. I don't need it. You know. Or pride can shut you off to the experience of mercy. And I just thought of just a practical example. Think of a spoiled kid. Think of a kid whose parents give him the world, but the kid thinks he deserves the universe. You know, the kid never has any love for his parents. He's getting mercy, right? The kid doesn't have a job. You know, and he's getting all these things, right? It's all mercy of the parents. Doesn't feel a drop of love, right? But think of a child in a proper family, right? The proper culture where he actually is so happy to be part of something greater than himself. Not the modern nuclear family, it's just a mother and father, and then the kid comes, and the kid's the center of the world from the beginning. As opposed to a joint family, you're loved, but you're one of many. You know, see, the kid gets spoiled. He doesn't experience, but if the kid, a very humble kid, you know, has the right ideals, you know, the right exemplars, right? Then the father pats the kid on the head. The kid melts with love. So it's the mercy is there from both sides, but it can't be experienced because of the consciousness. So I think really the practice of bhakti, and we discussed this before, is not just the activity, but the consciousness of dependence. Crying for the holy name, begging for the holy name. You know, if you're not humble, that you can't do that. And the example is something like, you know, you want to get into a door, right? And it's something behind the door, right? The person has to open the door. That's it. Yeah, and he doesn't have to. You didn't do anything for the person, right? Let you into his house, right? And you're crying. And you're begging. And you're screaming. And you're crying, please, please help me. And it comes from the heart. Then it attracts it. I remember one sannyasi told me he was swimming in the ocean, and then this beautiful young lady started to drown. Help me! Save me! Right? So what is he going to do? You know? Right? But by listening to the quality of the voice, he understood that it wasn't really sincere. So it's kind of like that. It's all the quality of our voice. You know, and do we really need God? We do, but we don't realize it. Because of ego. Ego makes us think that we're independent and that independence is better. Right? That's what ego does. It shields us. We can't. So the world almost is functioning to bring us to a condition of dependence. Not to bring us to a condition of dependence, to make us realize that. Any other questions? Yes. Are
Well, Madhavananda was, that was his class. But anyway, they... Oh, I see that. Yeah, without knowledge, you don't know what to do. And without discipline, you can't do it. Such a good question. Here's the reference that hopefully answers the question. Tatshradayana munayo gyanavairagya yuktaya pashantyatmani. Pashantyatmani. What? Bhakti Shruta Grita. The seriously inquisitive sage, well equipped with knowledge and detachment, realizes the absolute truth according to what he's heard from the Bhakti Shastras. And in that verse, what it describes, it says, there's two things. You have to be thoughtful and you have to be faithful. So you have to be thoughtful and you have to be faithful. And thoughtful means that you have to understand things. You have to understand things. And the example that was given in that, thoughtful and faithful, the example that was given in that is Lord Brahma heard the Vedas three times and then came to the conclusion that Krishna was the essence of, that bhakti was the essence of religion. So he heard it the first time, right? And it seemed like it was karma kanda, but he was thoughtful. He said, well, this doesn't make sense. And then he raised his doubt and Krishna explained it again. Then he saw the Upanishadic parts and he said, oh, it's jnana. But he said, well, how can it be jnana? Then he heard it again, and then it was bhakti. But even though I said that, I don't think it answered your question. So the relationship of knowledge and detachment. Yeah, you have to have some understanding, and you have to have some discipline. But that's not enough. I think that's the answer. It's not enough. That just puts you in a condition to actually receive devotion, because an impersonalist has knowledge and detachment. It won't necessarily lead you to devotion. So there still has to be some type of experience, which is actually, that experience is also beyond. It's not, when we have faith in Krishna, I don't think we it's just because we analyzed it. I think the knowledge enabled that conception to be reasonable so that we could experience it. Okay, any other questions? Yes. Go ahead.
I just had a thought in this discussion.
Yeah. Okay. Right. Well equipped. Beautiful. Wonderful. That's beautiful. Right. What? Go ahead.
So, in Rupa Goswami's Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, he says, Anyabhi Lashita Shinyam Jnana Karmadi Nabhita. And Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur says, is there a reason why he says Anabhitam and Shunyatam? Why the Anyabhi Lash or nonsense or the desire should be zero? But Jnana Karma Adi, Adi's, the Sabians, Parashram, Dharma, etc., some knowledge, some renunciation, shouldn't be a navitam. A navitam means you shouldn't cover it. Why not shunyatam? And they explain because some jnana, some karma can be beneficial. And Jiva Goswami says there's three types of jnana, tattvarata jnana, tamparata jnana, jiva brahma aiki jnana, knowledge of the soul, knowledge of God, and knowledge of the oneness. Knowledge of the oneness is detrimental to bhakti. But in the beginning, knowledge of the soul, knowledge of God, can be beneficial. In the beginning, Vanashram Dharma can be beneficial. In the beginning, Sambhava can be beneficial. But in Abhitam, it shouldn't cover bhakti. And he says it can cover bhakti in one of two ways. Number one, we can think that jnana or renunciation is the goal. And I'm doing bhakti so that I can become renounced. Or number two, we can cover bhakti that we think that unless I do this renunciation, I can't get bhakti. But it's ultimately vasarudhi bhavati bhakti yoga paroji dhyana yadgashyava yoga jnana shayana vaitakam. Bhakti gives birth to jnana vairagya. But in the beginning, they can be helpful.
Nice. Even that verse, Vasudeve Bhagavati Janayatna, Vasudevi Bhagavati Bhakti Yoga Pyojita. When you actually analyze the commentaries on that, what it says is that by devotional service, right, that these things come easy for the devotee. In other words, by devotion, you'll actually understand it easily. Yeah. And I really like your comment too, that it's not our objective, it's tools that we use. So that's good. Yes.
Just wanted to make a statement about suffering, you know, in regards to this question. Yeah. Krishna's not punishing anybody, you know. Anybody who's receiving suffering, or even everybody who's receiving enjoyment, it all has to do with their previous actions in the same life or in a previous life. You know, there's no, Krishna doesn't take, he's not involved in our suffering.
Okay, thank you. Okay, any other questions? Okay. Krishna. We'll give a few more and then.
It mentioned who cannot receive mercy from the Mahabharata.
Yeah.
Reflecting on that, I can identify that my culture and training is all time. And coming into the association of devotees is actually exhausting. There's constant judging and evaluating of the very process which is to bring me out of the material condition.
Yeah.
And I'm hoping for something where it seems like humility, there's a few elements that I'm just trying to secure a very formidable
path by which I can come out of the culture which I'm conditioned, and into that of the those who have mercy. It's a question, or I like the direction you're going in. And I hope you have good experiences that will overcome, you know, that will kind of overcome like the other type.
This, and then this.
Of how you get rid of fault finding? What? About what? About fault finding.
how we advance is through the mercy of the Mahabhagavata. We can't get the mercy of the Mahabhagavata if we have a little bit of knowledge and think we know better.
Well, just like I think King Prataparudra, you know, we cultivate the consciousness of a humble servant, and we actually do it, and that's so attractive because the external expresses our hearts, right? So we're actually putting, when we actually serve, we take our hearts and put it on our sleeve. When we don't serve, we also put our hearts and put blood on our sleeves. So I just think that it's just that mood. I mean, ultimately, like, I look at this, the hand, right? The hand is part of the body. And therefore, the hand is taking dictation from the body. Therefore, the hand is humble, right? Because it's part of something greater than itself, and it's taking dictation, right? But it doesn't mean the hand can't be strong, dexterous, beautiful. But it's humble. You know, we can have all the talents in the world, but it's humble if we just realize that the authority for the way things should be and what we should do lies beyond our own whims and selfish interest. You know, so I think just the mood of service and being part of something which is not about us. You know, and then in terms of fault finding, it's just a question of, you know, appreciation. Anyway, okay. Do you have a question? Yeah.
Just a kind of
a question.
Clear things up in my own mind.
Yeah.
That kind of the essence of the relationship between faith and knowledge,
yeah,
is you need to actually accumulate enough knowledge to the point that you realize that you don't know
anything. That you what?
That you don't know anything. And then upon that realization, then God, then you can, you know, sincerely cry out to Krishna.
Very nice.
You can be able to actually destroy your
very nice. You know, this is Alex. I just want to tell a story because it's kind of interesting how he got this realization. He was going to go to college, but he said, I don't want to go to college. So his mother and father were trying to convince him to go to college. He said, no, I think I'll just go to an ashram. He just wanted an excuse. So he started to Google ashrams. And then when he Googled ashrams, he was starting to think, I mean, I don't know about any of these ashrams. I could just be cheated. So then somehow or other, he wound up taking his mother to a George Harrison tribute in the Open Center. And it was given by Yogeshwara and this guy Godfrey Townsend, who's also a devotee. So he was listening to it about George Harrison in India. He said, well, Mom, maybe this guy knows a little bit about ashrams. You know, so they asked him, he said, oh, give me your email. So then, you know, he gave him the email. No, he said, I'll give you my email. He emailed, then he contacted me. To make a long story short, he winds up in the ISKCON Bhaktivedanta Ashram, sitting at the lotus feet of Keshava Bharti Maharaj, reading Srila Prabhupada's books for 6 hours a day for 3 weeks. What? What'd you say? I should only be so lucky? And then, you know, and you could see by that process, you know, the realizations were coming. The realizations where he got enough knowledge to realize that he didn't know anything. Jayadvaita Maharaj, when I took his class, Clear Thinking and Straight Speaking, he said one of the keys to a good lecture, right, is don't exhaust the questions.
He says, because if you end where there's a lot of questions, then they'll talk about your class after you finish. And it'll be even more specific. So now I think we have to do announcements. First announcement I'll say is we are going to go to the, yesterday at the end of the parikram, I was feeling exhausted. I was seeing the world according to my own desires. And I said, yes, everyone must feel, let's take a vacation today. And then I started to ask a few people, and they said, why? This is great. So then I had to change my mind. We will go to Haridas Thakur Samadhi, and we generally have a nice kirtan there, and then we sit. We have maybe a half hour, 45 minutes of guided japa. So it's very nice. The Siddha Bakul, thank you. The other thing is, tomorrow, giving the lecture will be Dr. Fakir Mohan. And it's kind of a wonderful experience to be in the presence of a Vaishnava who is in his, 75th year of chanting Hare Krishna. He also is an amazing person, Naistika Brahmachari, celibate his whole life. He was the chairman of the Department of Sanskrit of Utkal University. He has a PhD on Gaudiya Vaishnavism in Orissa. And then recently, 2 years ago, he completed his Doctor of Literature. That's his second PhD. And it's just charming, and he's quite humble. So I think it'll be a wonderful experience for us. He'll probably come this afternoon, and he'll give the class tomorrow, so that'll also be really nice. Krishna, are there any other? If you want to take Jagannath Mahaprasad dry with you, if you're going back to anything, please talk to Manoranjan.
Some devotees as they are leaving earlier.
And if for tonight, talk to him this morning. So Manoranjan, he supervises the prasadam, so you'll see him there. And then laundry arriving back tonight, so twenty rupees a piece. Please excuse us for the wet dhotis. Okay. If you're uncomfortable now. And if you want lunch today, we forgot about that yesterday, then see Sita Rani. And we went about 10 minutes over, so we can congregate at 10 o'clock. You'll hear the kirtan, and that means we're going to go within 5 minutes. Yeah.
So, two short things. One is today's Jayadeva Goswami's disappearance. If anybody's interested, there's about 5 articles about Jayadeva Goswami in the magazine. The second thing is there's a devotee named Mukunda who was in Bhubaneswar, and he's got lung cancer, and he died. 27-year-old man, he'll be coming to 40. So everybody's
going to say some prayer. Okay. Guru Prabhupada ki jai. Go Premanandi.